Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem.
Hi, Spring fans. Today's guest is Greg Turnquist, who's one of my favorite people on the Spring team. He typifies everything I love about this team. He's modest, hardworking, passionate, and willing to roll up his sleeves and tackle any problem in the name of the common good. Greg's career and his storied career, dating Harold, harking all the way back to Keith Donald and some of the original Spring sourcers from people from the team that predates even the acquisition at VMware in Florida, all the way to the modern day. Right, he's been with the community, with the team in some way or another for a long, long time. And what I think is most interesting about him is that he's just, you know, always doing something different. I write a thing called This Week in Spring, where I chronicle the adventures of our people and what they're doing. And that's, as you no doubt have gathered, it's one of the reasons I wanted to write this, it's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast, is because I think that the story of people involved in these teams is interesting. Greg is one of those people that I sometimes do double takes on. I look at what has been done in the last week sometimes, and ineluctably Greg is doing something, and it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what he would have been doing just a week or two before that. He is all over the place. He's just always willing to just tackle work and serve the community. So you might have worked with his code if you've used, for example, Hyperic or Tomcat or the JMS over RabbitMQ effort we had at VMware, the professional JMS over RabbitMQ effort, Spring Hatios, Spring Data Rest, Spinnaker, right? The Cloud Foundry Spinnaker integration from a couple years ago. He wrote a book called Learning Spring Boot for Pact. He was the lead of Spring for Python, right? And we share a common adoration for Python, the programming language. So I just find that there's just always something to talk to Greg about. I love talking to Greg because he's just really always interested in something, and he's always doing something interesting. And he's just a really great guy. So I was just very honored to have him as one of the first people with whom I conducted an interview for this podcast. I wanted to tell his story. He's exactly the kind of person that, if this podcast does anything, it would shine a light on people like him, because you know what? He doesn't shine it on himself. I mean, he's certainly deserving of the biggest and the brightest of lights. He is a star. But I think the thing that makes him a star is that he's just modest and he just wants to help, and he's just out there doing the work that makes Spring the ecosystem, as opposed to one particular project, a wonderful place to be. So without further ado, here's my interview recorded in May of last year with Spring engineer Greg Turnquist. Well, hello, Greg. How are you?
Hey, Josh. What's up?
Oh, good. Not too much. Not too much. I'm sorry we got started late, man. This, you know how it is. Busy days. I'm sure I'm dragging you right away, right from the middle of code, and that's the worst worst thing you can do to somebody on the Spring team. I know that. So sorry about that, but I appreciate you being so indulgent. So I'm glad to finally get a chance to record this podcast with you, man. It's been years we've known each other, and we never really got to do a profile or anything like that. And there's so much you're one of the I think most you're a V, you know, I don't know enough about sports to make this metaphor work, but you're a VIP, but you don't have, I don't think you, what's the, my dad used to tell me about this player named Magic Johnson. Is that right?
That sounds right, though. I'm not a sports enthusiast, so don't come looking at me for sports trivia.
and I guess Magic, dad would say, I guess he's considered the all-time great because not because he would do any one particular thing himself, but because he set up his teammates to be great. He'd always make sure that they were involved and that, you know, he was like the ultimate team player, and he just did whatever was necessary to get the team, you know, ahead. And in some ways I think of you quite like that. You don't seem to have
any one particular thing. You've never let yourself be specialized. You just seem to be willing to pull up your sleeves and work on whatever needs doing. And obviously you and I have something of a connection because we both love Python. So, I'm just super happy to talk to you. I hope, I hope our audience gets a lot out of this discussion today. So I guess there's a few things. First of all, can you tell us what about your journey? What is your journey to the Spring team?
Okay, well, we'll start off and say all hell Python. I don't know. I started off, I actually gave a presentation yesterday at my daughter's school for career day. I talked to four different classes and I had about 10 slides. And on one of them, I said, how I got started. And I flipped up a page of this antique book called Basic Fun. And it was, how to write apps with the basic programming language. And I think I was 10 years old when I got this book. And then I told them, don't go buy this book, go buy this other book. And guess what? It's a Python book. So, so hopefully they all went home and bought that. But
I hope so too.
But I started like writing apps, and my dad was he's a retired university professor, but at the time they had these things called luggable computers. So you could think of a laptop from the 80s, and it had a big strap and you carried around this giant case. So I would sit there and type these little apps into the computer, and I had fun trying to make this thing, make this computer do my bidding. So yeah. I always had early exposure to programming, but when I got into college, that's when it came for real. So I went to school and got a degree in computer engineering. And then I happened to go get hired at this company that I've later discovered was like the recruiting bed of SpringSource, because that was where there's a company called Harris Corporation, where Ben Hale came from, where Keith Donald came from, and
Jeremy,
that's where Keith Donald met his wife, apparently. And I can't remember if Jen was there.
So Keith Donald was one of the original founders of SpringSource, the company that was then eventually acquired by VMware. Jeremy refers to Jeremy Greley, and Jennifer Hickey, now Jennifer Greley. And did we miss anybody? And you. So, yeah.
So, So I worked there for several years, and that company is a big company. Probably about everything I did was government contracting stuff, legions of software developers darkening the skies to implement complex negotiated contracts, all this stuff. And back then I'd work extra hours. I'd stay late figuring out how to build stuff, because back then I was single. I didn't have a dog or anything like that, so I had fun just writing code like crazy. I remember working on, we won this big contract with the FAA. It was like, multi-billion-dollar contract. We had acquired this technology. It was a write once, run anywhere platform, not Java. It was something else. Sure. And we got it. We won a contract. We got started at it. A year later, Sun Microsystems acquired that company and end of life their product because it was awkward. Competitive with Java, but we were stuck with it. So for about 10 years, I worked on this, we built this mission critical ops center, 24/7, round the clock, internet, nationwide network for the FAA. And I was using this other technology, but in my spare time, I would go read all these blog articles about Spring. And I was like, this stuff's awesome. Can we migrate to it? Not today, No. And so when, back in 2008, I got married, and we'd made plans to move from Florida to Tennessee. And I was like, I want a different job. I want to, because my old company didn't exist in Tennessee. Let's move. How are we going to do that? I need another job. I want to go work for SpringSource. Let's go for the gold. I want to work for those people.
Yeah.
And, I schmoozed my company into sending me to the Spring One Experience conference in South Florida that year.
Well, that was a lucky break.
I went down there. Basically, I said, hey, you don't have to fly me. Just pay for a rental car. They said, okay. So I got a rental car. My wife and I went down there, and I made a point of like shaking the hand of everybody on the SpringSource team while I was down there. And I think I even absconded Adrian Collier in an elevator one time and greeted him. And back then I'd created this toolkit because I love Spring so much called Spring Python. And I even managed to write a book about it. But I went around. I remember chatting with Keith Donald, and I come to find out that the guy lives like half a mile down the road from where my office was back in. So I had to travel down to South Florida to learn this. But eventually I came back. I went down to his office. I gave him a resume. He looked at it. He said, there's a hiring freeze in place. By the way, do you want any Rod Johnson bobblehead dolls? And I swiped three on the way out. I got one right here on my desk now.
I've got a few of those laying around. I actually, Rod, his original, he's got one, right? You can imagine. yeah. And his actual, you remember a few years ago, I think Peter or somebody else sent out an email saying we've got a warehouse full of these little, not a warehouse, but a cage in a warehouse, whatever, full of these little bobbleheads. And would anybody like some? So I said, yeah, load me up. And I grabbed a few of them. Come to find out Rod's original, the one that he had, had broken, the chip had fallen or whatever. So I had the distinct pleasure of giving Rod for the second time his own bobblehead.
It's like an award bequeathing to him. Here's your award. I think there's a Twitter handle called Tiny Rod that people take pictures of the Rod Johnson bobblehead dolls in different places and they'll retweet it.
Yeah. I love it. Is no longer being maintained, sadly, but that was one of the best uses of the internet. If you have a reason to put bytes on the internet, I think that was the reason.
Florida. Yeah. So I was, I had started Job Shop and I was looking at other companies, and like a year later I get a phone call. It's interesting. My job, my manager played flag football with Keith Donald. One of the people down in the hallway was his wife is best friends with Jason Kanicki's wife. Jason Kanicki from, I don't know if he actually worked at Harris or not, but much strong spring support. But I got this phone call from, I forget who it was down there from the Florida team. It was Jason that called me up and they were like, are you still interested? And I'm like, yeah. And as I'm answering the phone, I'm walking outside the building so nobody at work can hear me talking to them.
Right.
And so over the next couple of days, I get a call from Jason, from Jen, Randy McBlain, who used to be our team director, whatever, before he retired. And, so they basically all interviewed me in the span of 2 to 3 days. And then somebody at VMware calls me up and makes me a job offer.
How quickly did you accept that? Was there a nanosecond precision or is it a microsecond?
The acceptance, well, the mental acceptance, yes. And then I was like, now it's negotiation time. Let's see. They're trying to squeeze me options. And I was like, let's do the salary. But that's all the details that anyway, we basically closed the deal on that. And then I was like, doing the tulip dance after that. So,
well, that worked out well. And you did Spring for Python. I'm a big fan. I use that a little bit and I quite liked it. I mean, it actually ports, Spring is nicely done, especially the core Spring framework is so nicely done as an object oriented thing that it any language that has support for Java, circa Java 1.4 era object orientation can do a reasonable job of porting the concepts from Spring. And of course, if you have extra syntax like lambdas and all that, then even better, right? I mean, and so you you did a very sort of a deft job of I think capturing the spirit of it while not exactly the same. You had objects instead of beans and things like that. I'm a big fan. That was a cool project. There's been a number of projects out there. There's a Spring for Cold Fusion.
I did not know.
Yeah, there's one for obviously about spring.net, of course. That was
Mark Pollack. Yeah,
Dr. Pollack's original thing. So and there's a Spring for I'm not sure about now, but there's a Spring for what was it? Flash ActionScript.
Oh yeah, I remember that vaguely.
Vaguely, yeah. So I'm sure there's others I'm forgetting, but. Of all the ones, of all those ones I just mentioned, the only one I ever was excited to really try was Spring for Python. Cause I thought, I love Python, I love Spring. What could go wrong? And it was actually a good, good fit. So you,
I thought it was neat, but the community didn't. So it sort of kind of died, but, there is a guy out there in Warsaw, Poland that actually uses Spring Python at the core of his Python based app server. So he's a buddy of mine. So, oh, well, anyway,
well, that was even before you got started with us and,
yep.
And what did you work on then? I mean, again, you limit your list to the first 50 different projects because you were
You know? Well, I got recruited to join the team. They had this commercial engineering team that was separate from the regular spring team. And so we had back then we had the AMS system and Hyperic HQ, mm-hmm. you know, this kind of ops management type toolkit. And they had this specific plug-in to connect to TC Server, the commercial version of Tomcat. And so they needed somebody to take that over. So I went in and took that over with almost zero knowledge of app server technology. So it's kind of like, and I found out the unit testing, that thing was really kind of crazy because you're talking about unit testing a plug-in to an app server to connect to another server. And I was like, the mocking, it's like we're getting into the movie Inception of how many layers deep can you go of indirection.
Wow.
So I started working on that. One of the people I got to work with a lot was Bruce Snyder, who's still at VMware. That was one sharp cookie. You know, he was a traveling consultant. And fun, after working with him, I discovered the guy had his college degree in like public affairs or something, nothing to do with computer science. So
yeah,
it proves you know, you don't have to be some computer junkie to actually get into this field and actually know what you're doing.
A little bit of perspiration and a lot of dedication. Yeah.
Trying to think the stuff back then I was so eager to get, the goal was I wanted to get on the spring team, but they hadn't hired me for that. So I got into the commercial engineering team. And right after that's when, I think they gave you an offer. They got, Craig Walls, Mr. Spring in Action author, and, Roy Clarkson.
Good old Roy. All those guys.
They came in to work on the Spring Social and the Spring Android stuff with Keith and all that. So it's like y'all came after me, but I was so jealous because y'all got to get right onto the Spring team, whereas it took me a couple years to work my way into that. But
well, you were part of the Spring team in here, and I think that was, especially those early few years at VMware, man, those were a little,
crazy.
Things changed so quickly. Yeah, they were crazy. Yeah.
That was, there was a little bit of mystery there. So whose mandate was what, but
right.
We managed to survive that because I liked it when they came out with the quote pivotal initiative where they basically they were splitting up the resources to be like, let's take the Spring team and let's take Gemfire and Green Tomcat. Plum, Tomcat. Let's put all this stuff into a combined effort. Because I think I remember traveling to conferences and stuff, and there was this kind of incongruous message about, there's cloud computing over here and then there's Spring over there. And I think it was like, I understand everywhere I go, if I use the word Spring, it opens doors. Everyone loves Spring. And I think it was our illustrious senior vice president, James Waters, that said, stick them, put them together. You go in and open the door with Spring, and then you can pitch cloud with that. And it's like just suddenly transformed, I think, the business model.
Absolutely. Software, as Mark Andreessen has said, is eating the world, James is, as on point. I always thought the whole pivotal initiative, the idea that we're contextualizing software as a business differentiator and the operations therefore need to be something that you care about, that was sheer brilliance. I'm a fan. From there, once we got that out of the way, at what point did you start working on the JMS for
Rabbit.
Yeah.
Oh wow, I'd forgotten about that thing.
I always think of that as being one of the coolest. Every time I hear from you, you're always up to your knees in some crazy in effort or some code that is just, oh my God.
Well, at the time I was sort of like working straight for Ryan Morgan. I guess it was before they made him the director, and I've been working on that Hyperic HQ stuff, but then we shifted and they needed somebody to take another odd job. And it seemed like I would get these assignments for a few weeks and then have to go work on something else. And Ryan and I would get together and chat. And he was like, this isn't our most effective usage of your talent to have you keep jumping from side job to side job. So we kept trying to put the feelers out for an opening on what to work on. And one thing that they needed some help on was Steve Powell, who was building like, can we implement the JMS spec on top of RabbitMQ, on top of the RabbitMQ server or whatever? So he was doing most of the legwork on it, but I was kind of helping out on some parts of that.
What's the TLDR?
Well, you can. It's like 99% of JMS just fits right in there, because what a lot of people don't understand is JMS, the JMS spec is a set of APIs. It says nothing about how the data travels over the wire. It just says, here's what the API has to look like. And that's kind of what Java is.
Yeah.
And Rabbit is built on AMQP, which is a, you know, from the wire up protocol. So you can really layer the two on. So at the time they made it commercial, but I think they've open sourced that since then. So I remember being asked to go write some blog article to demonstrate it. And this was back when I think before boot hit 1.0. So I went and I was like, let's go turn up the nerd knobs and try to build this demo app, but use the Spring Boot CLI and write it all in Groovy code. So I go write this blog post, and I mean, after writing this blog post demonstrating how to do a pub sub stock sample, I would get questions for the next 4 years about this blog article. They were like, I can't seem to run it. Something's missing. And I'm like, that would be the commercial library of RabbitMQ JMS that I couldn't put in the blog article because it was commercial.
Awkward.
So,
but now you can.
I guess now you can do it. And then, but the questions fell off, so I was kind of happy with that. Then,
yeah. So. And at this point, I'm pretty comfortable just recommending just use AMQP, just use RabbitMQ or Kafka or something like that. Why do you need JMS at all, you know?
Yeah, I think I wrote a book back in 2014, Learning Spring Boot, and in one chapter I did JMS messaging. And when I did the rewrite for that last year, I swapped JMS for AMQP. So
yeah,
all is well.
All is well. That RabbitMQ is really been impressed. That's one of those things I learned as I got to the company, you know, and I hadn't used it before, but it's a brilliant piece of work. I know people that have tried it. And having come from JMS, they love it, because if you're serious about messaging, why would you want to couple yourself? You know, why would you decouple everything except for the protocol and thus still necessitate flag day upgrades for client and server?
There's one time when we were trying to figure out what I was going to do, that I was tentatively going to go over to the RabbitMQ team. And that's when I had unearthed that whole thing is written in Erlang. And I was kind of like, hey, I'm ready to go for something crazy like that, if that's what it takes. But, turns out they didn't actually really need me over there. So, I didn't do that. But then I got this call from somebody named Brian Dussault.
Oh, that guy, he's trouble.
He had, apparently we picked up some big contract with Vodafone in the UK. And he was like, hey, you want to come join my team to go work on Vodafone? And I was like, sure. And I would love to do that. That sounds great. And I didn't have a clue what I would be doing. but talking with Brian for 5 minutes, I was like, I'm sold. I'll be on his team, whatever his team is doing.
Brian Dussault, by the way, he's the R&D manager for the Spring team. And just, I don't even know. There's not a pedestal high enough for this guy. He's just a class act. If you ever get a chance to interact with him at Spring One Platform or anything else, dear audience.
I've worked for lots of different managers throughout my career. And I mean, I never pass over the opportunity to hit yourself to a very good manager, because it doesn't, it's like, it doesn't matter what you're going to work on. It's going to be good.
Yeah. Brian is, that's him.
But I remember like a month after saying, yeah, I'll do that, he called me up and said, we're not doing the Vodafone contract. I got a better opportunity. And I was kind of, you know, going, oh no, what, you know, am I not going anywhere? And he says, well, they need somebody to take over the Spring team, because Randy McBlain, or I guess, was stepping down. I think maybe at the time he was the R&D director over that also.
Yeah.
He's like, They got an opening to run the Spring team. You want to come with me and work on the Spring team? And I'm like, are you kidding me? That's the whole point. I've been here. So I jumped at that, and then I got onto the team, and then they really didn't assign me to any of the particular portfolio projects. And I was like, what am I supposed to work on? He was like, well, I'm not sure. There's something we need to work on. Have you ever met Chris Beams? And I was like, yeah, I chatted with him back in 2008 at that conference. he said we're gonna basically blow up the website and rebuild it from scratch using Spring Boot, and as a demo, you know, they need help working on that, and we need to write some content to hang on the website. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
And I think go ahead.
Oh, so I remember that was the Sagan initiative, right? And
yes,
I remember you are today still, I think, the lead of all the guides. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I've gently adopted the title editor at large. Basically, Chris Beams, who lives in Austria, last time I checked, had come over, I guess, to San Francisco and was working with the Pivots, you know, pairing up so that we had you know, Pivotal Labs people building the site, and then he, myself, Craig and Roy were working on the content. We were like, we're shooting to do about 40 guides and get them out by Spring One conference of 2013. And so we like spent all summer writing a bunch of content. And I mean, Chris had come out with a very clear mandate. He was like, we're going to write these guides. The goal is like a lunchtime amount of knowledge, like 15 to 30 minutes. And we don't want people to have to jump to other sources to complete the guide. They should be able to read everything they need right there in one guide. And yeah, those constraints, as simple as they sound, really are tough to enforce. Because a lot of times you're like, could I go sidetrack over and do this or sidetrack, or this seems to be duplicating something in another guide. No, we need to keep it where they don't need to complete another guide before they do this guide.
And, you know, I was pretty, in retrospect, obviously very incorrectly opposed to that idea. At first I thought, well, we have the internet. Why wouldn't we want to link related concepts? But wow, yeah, Chris and you all were just straight up, 100% correct. That was a brilliant insight, and it's sort of like haikus. You know, you have a constraint; it fosters creativity. The result has been, it speaks for itself. The guides are one of the most popular things that we, you know, that plus the initializer, I think, are, is that fair to say, probably the most visited pages on the websites.
You know, I'll say, you know, Chris deserves the credit for coming up with the idea, and we've seen it proven out in the sense that, I think this year on my birthday, everyone, you know, retweeted me on, you know, on Twitter and stuff. And they're like, you know, congratulations, Mr. Spring Guides. So yeah, absolutely. I found that hilarious. And when I went to, I think I went to the Dev Nexus conference in 2015 and met Dan Allen there, who leads the ASCII Doctor project. And by the way, I handed him a copy of my Learning Spring Boot book written in ASCII Doctor. Yeah. He chatted with me about they were wanting to do, he was being hired to write some guides for Gradleware. And so he was like trying to get some insight into the guide stuff, because, you know, that had been my shtick. So the fact that I've seen them pop up everywhere there, I think Microsoft is doing a slew of guides right now. It's become the part and parcel of, if you want to demonstrate your technology, build a set of tiny guides.
Yeah. A lot of different. Yeah. I've seen a lot of different, even some of the competitors have adapted that same approach. Now, you are definitely, you have made a huge impact in the world with the guides, but I don't want the dear audience to be confused here. That is not by any stretch that was, you know, I know you do that as on one of your, I know you have like 36 hour long days somehow and you managed to get that done. But you also do, what else did you work on? You did, the Spring Data REST stuff. I know you've done.
It was right after. So it was right after that conference that, you know, I'd been several months on the Spring team without an assignment. And I was kind of like talking like, Brian, I don't want to do guides for, I don't want to make that like my day job, if you will. And he says, well, I got somebody I'd like you to meet that maybe this would be a good fit. You tell me, it's your choice. And so like right at the tail end of the 2013 conference, I sat down and chatted with Oliver Gierke.
Oh, that's another guy who's trouble.
And that's the first guy I'd met him. And Brian was like, yeah, I want you to meet this guy. And people refer to him as Mini Jurgen.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not sure what that means, but I think I'm going to find out. Yeah. And he was like, we've got this one project, Spring Data REST, that we don't have anybody managing. So would you like to come on the team and work on that? I was like, oh, sure. Yeah. That'd be great. And then I started to find out what I did and did not, more importantly, did not know, understand about REST, because I would come up with ideas like, can we do this? And he would say, I don't think that's a good idea. What about that? No, that doesn't really fit. That's not REST.
Right.
That's how
he had the nice thing about Oliver is Ollie's always well informed. He's got the depth to explain his prescriptions. I love that.
Oh, very much. And I can remember having this chat with him at the time about that, and just, you know, talking about Spring Data REST at the conference. And right after that, he went over to talk to Jurgen, and so they started immediately chatting in German. And I could make out bits and pieces of it. And I was like, "That's an incredibly complex discussion. And I was like, that's part of why I like coming to this team, because it seems like everybody around me knows so much stuff about either the JVM, or they understand about architecture, or, you know, what does dependency injection really mean? That it's like, you can come here and actually, you know, you learn stuff and you improve yourself while helping other people.
Yeah, I that's a great point. Would it be fair to say that the Spring team operationalizes and or makes production ready things that I think would have hitherto been sort of the exclusive enclave of academia and research, you know, ALP, dependency injection, and indeed very specialist systems, you know, specialized systems like batch processing. You know, it takes expertise to be able to take all these things and make them general purpose. But I think, if anything, the Spring team has done that, and that's a big part of the success, you know?
Absolutely. So I got onto the Spring Data team and worked on Spring Data REST, and I found out Spring Data REST was really complicated, because Spring Data REST is comprised of Spring Data Commons. So you have part about query manipulation and stuff like that, and how Spring Data Commons operates. It has Spring MVC in it, and it uses really some of the most internal core complicated stuff, aspects of Spring MVC, and then it uses Spring Framework itself. So, and then it has its own code. So when something is going wrong, or you want to change something, you're having to figure out, where do I need to go change? Which aspect of this am I supposed to go adjust? Do I need to fix it in the Spring Hadios project, or in the Spring Data project? And I was a little in over my head at trying to grasp what all that was.
Well, you learned pretty quickly, didn't you? I know there are some features in Spring Data that have been the direct result of your feedback and the tension you're trying to work with in adding features to Spring Data REST. And I know there's features in Spring Hadios as well, right? Or that, you know,
yeah,
that.
Yeah. The, one of my favorite things to do when I'm sitting there trying to figure out how to use something is I try to go, you know, I go build a demo app. Mm-hmm. I'm like, let me build an app, see if I can understand how to use it. And here we, you know, Boot was coming onto the scene, so it made it faster than ever to go build a demo app. And you may enjoy this story, is back in 2015, I needed to have a demo app, and I wanted to use Spring Data REST. And I had this, I knew about this particular developer advocate that traveled around to conferences and would take a selfie of himself, himself and the audience on the stage.
I wonder who.
And so my thought was, Can I build the app that you're uploading the picture? Can I build an app that does that and puts it up on the screen as a demo? So I started to model that, and I was like trying to figure out, like, so how easy is it to like take a shot with your iPhone? And I found out not that hard.
Right.
So I had to dig in some JavaScript stuff, but I was able to like kind of define most of that back end app with Spring Data REST, and it made for an entertaining demo and became the demo code that's in my latest version of Learning Spring Boot.
Oh, that's so cool. I love it when these things get reused because there's a continuity, you know, it's like a continuity of expertise. People start with a nugget of knowledge, and it flowers as they start to, you know, I think all of us are in the Spring team. There's breadth, right? All of us are masters of something, one or two things, and we have to, because of the nature of what we do, we have to be sort of a breadth first as well, right? We have to be able to do everything and then be good at a few things. And I love when you can take a little seed of an idea and then it snowballs into this really interesting, and then eventually a project or a book or whatever. You see that a lot with creative people on the Spring team and I suppose elsewhere.
Well, So I've been working on the Spring Data REST stuff. So I've been, you know, one of the things I like to claim credit for is that I probably increased the reference documentation like by 50%. Cause I was like, hey, how do you do this? And Ollie would say, oh, that's just this feature. And that's that feature. I said, well, that's not in the ref docs. I'm going to go put that in the ref docs and point out how to do that. So, you know, I've grown the scope of that, and we were going along, and I got contacted by Brian and, James Waters, that apparently there was this effort afoot over at Netflix called Spinnaker. And they were like, what do you think? You know, could you go poke your nose into it and see if it's possible to have Spinnaker work with our Cloud Foundry stuff. And I was like, what is Spinnaker? And I had to go,
What is Spinnaker?
For the I had to investigate. It turns out it was Netflix's continuous deployment pipeline. So,
build and bake, pipeline.
Yeah. They have this really, you know, I discovered that Netflix was like making 2000 commits a day. And every time they do a commit, it would roll out an update to the app. And so, I was kind of really intrigued with this. Now, they use AWS for their cloud platform, but apparently they had pulled on people like Google and I see Microsoft had joined the team. And so they were like, you know, can we have support for Cloud Foundry? You know, is that possible?
What is the difference between this tool, Spinnaker, and your Jenkins or your Concourse or, you know, these sorts of things?
You know, you could say at one level they all sort of do the same thing, but some of the key distinguishing elements about Spinnaker is that they have built into the platform primitives for like doing roll forward, roll back. They have the concept when they roll out an app, they need to roll out 10,000 instances of it. You know, bake an image. You know, spin up 10,000 copies. They definitely do this immutable infrastructure. It's like if you wrecked the object, you know, if you wrecked the code, you need to go tweak the code and put out a new release. Don't go try to patch the server because that server is probably going to be gone in 2 hours.
Yeah, at their scale, and that implies that you need to do rolling restarts and you need to have the ability to deploy this thing gracefully and verify that it works and so on, right?
Yeah, this whole idea of I'm going to SSH into a server and I'm going to upload a jar file and unpack it, that's like, oh, I've got all this nice control, but it is very inefficient to operate that way.
Yeah.
So they're impressive. And, you know, the other eye I had on this is the fact that I'd worked in an ops center for 10 years and I'd had to build a UI for, you know, this network management system at my old job. And so I knew what kind of stuff that people said, this looks good on the screen. This information is a waste of time. We need a certain perspective. And the UI for Spinnaker was very impressive to me for somebody from an ops perspective.
So that's telling. Yeah. You'd think with a company like that and their scale, that would be one of the things they focused on.
So I jumped in and I ended up spending about 2 years coding support for that to make Pivotal Cloud Foundry a target cloud solution for that. And, you know, we made a lot of progress and stuff on that. And I there were some bumps that I ran into to deal with, like, you know, we Ben Hale rewrote the Cloud Foundry Java client library to use the Reactor stuff. And so I was trying to update to that, but the version of Spring Boot that Spinnaker ran on wouldn't support it. And so when I tried to go make updates to it, I ran into a lot of resistance and stuff. And so, and at the same time I'd gone to conferences and presented about it while also developing the code to do this. And when Brian asked me, you know, let's look at how many clients are actually using it. I couldn't count on one hand how many people, customers that we had actually using it. So we decided to deep six the effort last year, you know, back in February.
Mm. Well, that's a bummer. And it seems like it's one of those things that would be more useful than ever these days, you know, with the with more and more applications moving to the cloud native way, you know, this testing and blue green deployments and all these kinds of things. Well, so that leaves us back to, that gets us back to roughly last year, you said. Where does that leave you now? What are you doing these days, my friend?
Well, when I was rolling off of that, so Brian was like, well, you know, we got a couple of places for you if you're interested. If not, we can keep looking. But they said they're looking for somebody to get on Project Reactor team, and they're looking for somebody to come onto the Spring Data team. And that was a very hard decision because I'd already been seeing the moves that they've been making on Reactor to do the reactive stream stuff. And it looked very interesting and intimidating all at once. And I thought, well, I could probably learn a lot there. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I got this Ollie reached out to me on Slack and is like, hey, if you come on board Spring Data team, we're going to have a team meetup in Berlin in like a month. And we'd hate for you to miss out on that. And that pushed me over. And I said, okay, I'm going to do Spring Data again.
Yeah.
And then I found out how you do a rushed passport through the government. So I had not traveled internationally for years. So.
Right. Well, now you've got your passport. The door is open. You can, I'm sure you'll I'm sure we'll see more of you around.
So I dove back into that, and I chatted with Ollie, like, you know, what's the target here? And I said, look, the last time I was here, I tried Spring Data Rest, and I was a little in over my head. I think I would like to work, like, I know you also need help on Spring Hadios. What if I start there and then work my way up? And he said, that sounds great. So we're kind of meeting to have our annual, you know, let's plot out what we're going to do for the next year. And it's weird when you say I'm going to work on Spring Hadios while I'm on the Spring Data team, but Spring Hadios is one of Ollie's babies.
Right.
So, you know, he's not purely a data head. If you actually sit down and chat with him, he's really this kind of systems developer. Yep. You know, he's gone around and given a lot of talk about systems of systems. And it's like, let's go look at all the trade-offs between whether you need a monolith or a microservice, because the reason you're jumping to microservice may actually make things worse if you don't have the right concept of what your systems are.
Yeah.
And a side effect is the way you structure your data. So I started making lists of like, well, here's all the stuff I'd like to do for Spring Hadios. And Ollie said, here's these other things that we've been looking at and I haven't had time to look into. So I made a point of like going and starting to read every line of code in that project. And I felt like I could really grok what that thing was doing and started coming up with ideas. Like, you know, we had new media types that were coming out.
Yeah.
You know, when he started the project, there was no such thing as HAL. Hypertext application language. So he used whatever Jackson produced, but they came out with HAL, and there's this other guy, Mike Amundsen, that has come out with other media types like collection JSON and Uber is this other type he came up with. And I found out that this Mike Amundsen guy lives about 3 hours away from me, so I'm going to try to choreograph going up to visit him sometime, because he really likes what we're doing with Spring Hadios.
Yeah, he's a API evangelist or something like that.
Yeah, and he's a really big time REST advocate. So when you get on the debates on Twitter about when people say that's not REST, he's the guy who does know what REST is.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I've seen those. I've seen those back and forth. He's a Restafarian.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So that's great. You're back. So what are some of the? I know you've added a couple of encodings besides HAL to Spring Data REST and Spring HadiOS. ALP.
Yeah, it's called ALPS. Yeah. ALPS is sort of a profile type, so you can have that adjacent to your app. So the data can be a HAL document, but if you look up on, like, give me the descriptor on this data, you can get an ALPS document that describes all the fields. And then Ollie had found this other format called HAL Forms, which is just an extension of HAL that has some more data elements that kind of gives you the same information an ALPS document would give you. What we're seeing is that HAL is like probably about the simplest form of hypermedia you can find out there. It's got the data and it's got the links, but it doesn't tell you how to use the links.
And right, what verb?
Yeah, what verb? What attributes do you need to use on the link to actually make it work with a put or a patch or whatever? And the HAL specs document does tell you how to do that. It has the extra data to cover that. The idea is you can use a HAL forms representation to craft an HTML form programmatically. And so that way the client, you know, the web page doesn't really need to know anything about the domain model. It just needs to fetch the document, render the form, and show the form to the human being driving the web page. And the human's going to understand how to use that. So it reduces the coupling between the client and the server.
Wow, that's a really powerful, that's really powerful. Have you tried, I know Ollie's got his Spring REST bucks. Have you tried adding user interface to that? And
so I haven't gotten into that yet. So, and that would be definitely a candidate. I actually had created a parallel project called Spring Hadios Examples.
Yeah.
As something to co-demonstrate all these different concepts. Because one thing I ran into was when we had that team meeting in Berlin last year, Ollie set us all up to go speak at the Berlin Jug meeting. And we went there and, Ollie's the most humble guy I know. You know, we get into the meeting, he stood in the back and let the rest of us do all the talking. He wasn't trying to be some glory hound or anything.
Nope.
And I'd coordinated with the other guys to be able to get a dig in for my book that was coming out. So I had a picture snuck into the slide, but, after the meeting, we're sitting there chatting for like we're chatting with people and sipping on sodas and stuff. And this guy comes up to me and got this real thick accent. And he's like, Greg, it's so good to meet you. And I'm kind of like, who are you? And he goes, you may not recognize me, but I helped you on the soap guides.
Oh,
and then suddenly it clicked. It was the guy from Warsaw, Poland that had helped me fix the consuming and producing soap guides on the website. And that guy was my greatest hero, you know, for working on that technology.
So a different guy from Warsaw, Poland,
yes,
than the one working on Spring Python.
Yeah. So this now, if you count Marcin, that's the three people I know from Warsaw, Poland, and they're all incredibly technically astute.
And Spring enthusiasts.
And Spring enthusiasts. It's awesome. And then for the next hour, he started asking me these really hard questions on REST and Spring Hadios and Spring Data REST. And he says, well, why should we care about any of this Hadios stuff? Why? What of value is it? And so I was like, I did not expect this. So I immediately was put on the spot. And I was like, and this is what it means when you're on the Spring team, is you can go anywhere and people will be all over you.
Yeah. What a good problem to have too. And that's, and that reminds me, you worked on Spring WS, didn't you? You had, maybe not a lot, but didn't I see you in there somewhere at some point?
Yes. In fact, that was somewhere in the middle when I was working on Spinnaker. I'm trying to think if we were in Las Vegas for that Spring One conference when, Arjen came up to me and it was like, apparently they needed, may have been before Vegas, they needed somebody to take over Spring WS because Arjen was going on a 3-month paternity leave. Because in the Netherlands, when you have a baby, you get 3 months off.
Nice.
And so well-deserved. I was like, good for you. I guess I'll do it. You know, it's like somebody needs to do it. And so I had several Skype chats with Arjen while he briefed me on it. And, and so I got eased into Spring Web Services, and we're told it's like, we're not trying to do anything new. We need somebody to maintain it.
Yeah. Well, I know you released at least a couple. I saw your name go through This Week in Spring, so you know, related to Spring WS at least once or twice. I mean, you're everywhere, my friend. You're everywhere. The team is definitely better for your contributions.
Well, this is, you know, and this is something I've come to, you know, when I've chatted with Arjen and stuff and asked questions, and I've discovered what, you know, has been around for a while, known as the Putzma principle, because that's his last name, Arjen Putzma. And and the Putzma principle is that if Arjen can't understand what you're doing, then you're probably wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's more eloquently is that whenever you try to propose something, he'll say, that sounds too cute, or that sounds, you know, too slick or too tricky. Probably not a good idea. Let's try to look for a simple solution. And that kind of edict really has a lot of impact, because the Spring way is about simplifying Java, not making it more complex.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't do a lot on there, though lately yesterday was like, you know, I need to find out if Spring Web Services runs on Java 10. Let me see if I can do that.
Oh dear. So, how'd that go?
It wasn't as hard as I thought it would be. I had to go do a bit of reading. And then once I figured it out, I was like, now I need to go have the CI server build Spring Web Services and all its profiles against Java 8 and Java 10. And that was when I've exceeded the limit of Travis CI. So I migrated it to Circle CI, where I could dial in the versions of Java in every job.
Nice. Oh, it's convenient. So,
and it's like, this is all just for sustainability. So when somebody calls up, they can be like, oh, okay, this does work on Java 10. Thanks.
Right. Yeah, that's becoming an increasingly important for something that's supposed to be write once, run anywhere. It is certainly starting to become, it's becoming a testing burden, isn't it, for us on the Spring team. We've got a number of different projects that test against concurrently against a number of different Java versions because of the, first of all, big releases, Java 8, for example, is nothing like Java 7, and the module path makes Java 9, 10, 11 a different proposition compared to Java 8. So,
yeah, I'd done all this digging and discovering, like I was doing all these add module calls, and then because apparently all the Java EE packages are they've been modularized, and they're actually being pulled out. They're being removed from the JDK by Java 11. So I uncovered that all these add module calls are actually not very effective, because by Java 11, there's going to be nothing to add. So you have to actually add another dependency or two or three.
Right. Like JaxB.
Yeah. JaxB or JaxRS, or in this case, you know, JaxWS. And so I was like having to go unearth that and figure out how to do it. And you know, let's get Maven to do it. Now let's go get Circle CI to build six different variations of this project so we can maintain that we have backwards compatibility and that there's no breaking stuff coming from, you know, the next version of Spring Framework.
Isn't it amazing? So this kind of stuff, these efforts that you just described, this is the reason that people love Spring. And it's the reason like that people like me can use Spring is because somebody like you, somebody who's got their head in the game and really cares about delivering quality, has taken the time to make sure it works against all these different permutations of Java, so that by the time the end user gets the bits, hopefully the experience is smooth. And, you know, as you know, there's everybody, nothing is perfect, but I would say by and large, 99% of the time, we do a good job. You know, the Spring team does, the Spring team does a great job there.
I didn't know how much of an effort it was to do this non-breaking backwards compatibility stuff until I got into Spring Framework. And I didn't understand that. You know, I remember seeing Jürgen chatting at some kind of it was like a Birds of a Feather thing, like back in 2014, and talking to people about how, you know, Spring 4 is JDK 8 ready. And I'm like, what is that? What do you mean? And he was saying, you know, it's Java 6 was what people were running on. But if you were running Java 8, stuff turns on. And I'm like, how do you do that? How is that possible? Yeah. What do you mean it turns on? I don't understand. And I would look in the code and I would find out what that meant. There's stuff buried, you know, there's this reflective calls buried in the code that looks at telltale signs of, oh, you're in JDK 8, so we can turn on this extra chunk of code for you. And I was like, I didn't know that was possible in Java.
It's like JavaScript object detection, but for Java.
Yeah. And it's like buried in, you can find it buried in Spring Data and the other stuff. So, you know, now it's like shorthand when I'm like, okay, Jackson has just put out a point release and they've broken their APIs again. Are we going to do a reflective hack on this? Or are we going to just tell everybody they got to upgrade? And it's this analysis of what do we need to cover, you know? And I was like, this is stuff I never would have learned, you know, at my old job.
Spring Boot formalizes this. There's so many, you know, conditions that go into any given working program, and Spring Boot at least now has a, you know, the conditional annotation instead of Spring Framework 4, and Spring Boot and all of its permutations of add conditional, I think, do a lovely job of sort of allowing us to write code that takes advantage of all these different cues, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last project I got, and I just have a few minutes here I can squeeze in, is that while I was working on my book, the latest book, Learning Spring Boot 2.0 Second Edition, I made good a deal with Pack Publishing.
Huh? Good book, by the way. Congratulations.
Thank you. The whole book is written in the reactor paradigm. So I needed a reactive data store to underpin it. So I picked MongoDB because it was at the perfect intersection of, you know, Spring Data had support for it in reactive, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And at one point I was compiling the code, which I had worked on this code for over a year. Kind of before Spring Boot 2.0 had hit the scenes. And I discovered that the chapter 9 that uses Spring Session suddenly wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And that's because I wasn't aware that Rob Winch, the lead for Spring Session, had pulled out MongoDB support. He had narrowed the supported data stores in Spring Session proper. And so I chatted with him over a span of a couple of days, and I agreed to create a fork project, Spring Session for MongoDB, just so I could put the book back in action.
So now you're the maintainer of that project.
Now I'm the maintainer of that project. And I've had people ask, can you backport this feature to 1.3? And I said, no, because in 1.3 there is no MongoDB support. So no. And I've one of the biggest lessons I've learned from Ollie is sometimes you just have to say no. No.
Yeah, it's better for everybody. Wow.
So
what a renaissance nerd. You're amazing, my friend. What is the one takeaway? I'll give you a second to stew on that, but I would have people remember that you're Greg Turn on Twitter. Is that true?
That is true.
That's true. And you are the Mr. Spring Guide. So spring.io/guides, all those guides were lovingly curated and updated and maintained. And whenever there's a new version of Spring Boot, Greg is the one who pulls the lever and makes them move to the next version and releases them. And I've worked on a few of those guides and you've curated those and, you know, guided me through the process. And you've also facilitated third party contributions from ecosystem partners, right? So the Vaadin and the Spring, the GCP stuff. I mean, all these, it's not just you updating guides that were written. It's also you acting as a liaison, if you will, or Sherpa for new content from our vast ecosystem of partners. And then what else? Oh, your book is Learning Spring Boot, second edition, Pact Publishing, very well reviewed, very liked book. I liked it a lot. Very good book. Anything else you want people to know about?
Well, the other thing I'm out to do is I want to try to get the right message of rest out there. So I'm really excited about working on the Spring Hadios and the Spring Data Rest stuff. So it's just, hey, use Spring. It's like it's the best, right?
it's gonna be big one day, man. It's gonna be big.
All right. Well, good chat.
Yeah, thanks for your time, dude. You have a wonderful weekend. And, to all those listening, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
A Bootiful Podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. So I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email or at starbuxman on Twitter, where, of course, my direct messages are wide open. Do you have any guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback, etc.? Please don't hesitate to reach out to me. Or, indeed, you can ping me at bootifulpodcast on Twitter. So at bootifulpodcast. On Twitter. If you like the show, if you like the podcast, please rate it accordingly on iTunes or wherever you download your podcast, because that, of course, helps the circulation of the show. It helps the show get better, find a wider berth, and so on. I sampled music from Steve Combs' theme From a Morning in Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.